Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Morty Yulofsky, and on behalf of the Campus Community Committee, I'm pleased to welcome everyone to this lunch hour talk. Our speaker today is Professor Gil Troy, a colleague and also a good friend of mine. And really, it's a delight to hear him. I heard Gil speak about 2 years ago, just after Obama came into power. And now we have the opportunity to hear Gil talk about, and I do like the topic that he selected because it's very academic, Obama at the midterm grading the professorial president, which is just about what is going to be happening about 2 weeks from now for all the students here within the university. Gil had joined McGill in 1990, just after he graduated, just slightly after he graduated from Harvard University. He did all his studies at first at Harvard College and then Harvard University. And we're fortunate that he's been with us for over 20 years. I can talk about many things with Gil, and I can say that Gil has published 6 books. Is it only 6? Because I just can't keep up with the books in terms of sort of, shall we say, the rapidity in which they come out. Morning in America, How Ronald Reagan. Okay. I apologize. Managing in America, How Ronald Reagan Invented the 1980s. Leading from the Center, Why Waters Make the Best Presidents, The Reagan Revolution, and Hillary Rodham Clinton, Polarizing First Lady. So those are among 4 books that have been published in the last 4 years, I believe, right, since 2006. So therefore, when I say 6 books, I cannot tell whether anything else has already come out in publication over the last couple of months. But it's really our pleasure to invite one of our faculty members who might give us a bit of a prognostication in terms of what may be happening over the next 2 years with the current president in power, Obama at the midterm. Thank you.
And thank you all for coming in the middle of your lunch hour. It's a great sacrifice. And I love this idea of the campus community, because I think that's really why so many of us are drawn to the university, the idea of community, the idea of building something that goes beyond our individual selves and creates something that is committed to something. Certain ideals, civility, tolerance, knowledge, education. And today we're going to, in that spirit, see, can we talk about politics without being partisan? And that's always the challenge that I give when I teach my course on presidential election campaigning or on the history of the United States from 1865 to the present, or from 1965 to the present. I say, can we talk about the tough issues without necessarily immediately going into the left or the right barricades that we see so often in the blogosphere? And we see today, we're looking at the professorial president. He's one of us. He was a lecturer at University of Chicago in law school, and that's for better and for worse, I have to say, during the campaign. One of my fears about Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and John McCain was that none of them had any managerial experience. They had about as much managerial experience as I have, having been department chairman for exactly 1 year. And knowing how little that means, and knowing how much I depended on my departmental secretary in order to get everything done, I said, how are these people going to go from managing their small Senate offices to managing the complex, crazy, multidimensional, multifaceted office of the presidency in the United States of America? And that's the opening slide. The second slide there is that I should be clear, there has been no official announcement, emphasize official announcement, of the Barack Obama second term attempt. But and I certainly, my other challenge when we talk politics and talk history is, can we talk about this without predicting the future? I would say it's hard enough to predict the past. I can't begin to predict the future. But it does certainly seem that there are blueprints going on for the second term. And finally, last introductory remark is, it's really extraordinary that we're meeting today. And we picked the state 7 months ago because we knew that tonight there'd be this speech about Libya. And we'll have an opportunity, no, joking, right, because it was just announced last week. But in discussing Obama's challenges and discussing what's going on, we're going to be hopefully learning new ways to listen to tonight's speech. and learning new ways to think through the presidency. And that gets to this opening picture, which is two gentlemen you might be familiar with, Barack Obama and Stephen Harper. Yeah. And modern media types like to talk about spinning. We historians prefer to talk about framing. You look at that picture and say, how is it framed? And I have to say, when it first was talked about that there was going to be a summit between Barack Obama and Stephen Harper, the reason why I don't predict things is because I'm often wrong, one of my predictions was it could be that all we would hear about would be the dour conservative, and the charismatic left-winger. But instead, the frame, most recently, was the two youthful leaders of the North American hemisphere. And it's important to see that sometimes those frames, as they shift, can be illuminating, sometimes they can be obscuring. And one of the things we want to be asking are, what are the frames that we use when we look at Barack Obama? And to understand Barack Obama, to understand what's going on right now, we have to channel back really to two moments. One moment is in the corner over there, in 2004, when John Kerry, remember him, who was running against George W. Bush, remember him, for the presidency, in an act of real mentorship, the kind of mentorship that goes on every day that we take for granted in the university, turned to this young, unknown state senator from Chicago who was running for Senate from Illinois. This guy, Barack Obama, had such a strange name. That's why he described himself. And such an unfamiliar name that the first time someone walked into the White House with an Obama button, George W. Bush went, Osama? And he wasn't even making, he was sort of like, you know, because he sort of put the words together. It wasn't on purpose. It was just, like, what is this? And how could it be that in 2004, 3 years after that traumatic moment, someone like Barack Obama was able to come on the political scene, get this gift from John Kerry of the podium, of the microphone, at the Democratic National Convention, give a keynote address. Little historical fact. It was not televised live. Because the powers that be said, who's this guy? We're waiting for Ted Kennedy. That will show. Waiting for a Clinton. That will show. But we're not going to show. It used to be that you showed gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Democratic and Republican National Conventions. Of course, if you watched McNeil Air, if you watched PBS, you could watch it. And C-SPAN. But NBC, ABC, NBC, CBS, the three big networks said, we're not going to put this on. So it wasn't on live network television. And this young, charismatic guy gets up and he gives a vision of America. He talks about America that's not sliced and diced into the red states and the blue states. He talks about an America that can be multicultural and national. That can have individual expressions of ethnic affiliation, of religious affiliation, but also can be part of one great nation. And it's electric. And he spends the next 4 years pretty much running for president. And in the first 2 years denying it, and the next 2 years running like crazy. Of course, the titanic battle with Hillary Clinton. And comes up with this whole vision of yes, we can. And he always calls it the ancient, traditional American call of yes, we can. He made it up. But that's one of the things that we see in American politics is the need to sort of steep it, to coat it in tradition. And that makes it valid. So this vision of yes, we can, you can see him being swept up in the crowds. And we know that extraordinary moment in November 2008. America was on a downswing, traumatized by the fight over the Iraq War and the way the United States has gotten bogged down in that. Traumatized by the divisive presidency. You can love him or hate him, but it was divisive presidency of George W. Bush. Traumatized by the stock market crash. I don't think that in the entire history of presidential elections there's ever been such a cataclysmic domestic event so close to an election. And Barack Obama was elected that night. And two people play their role so beautifully, so elegantly. The first one, John McCain. McCain, who had been known as Mr. Civility, but frankly during the campaign had gone to be a little bit more like Mr. Divisive. But he gets up at that moment and gives the concession speech of his life. Gives really a great concession speech, a graceful concession speech, a concession speech that talks about uniting and healing. And then Barack Obama gets up, standing there alone, you may recall, in Grant Park in Chicago, and gives a speech echoing through the ages, talking about generations of Americans who had yearned for this moment. And it was extraordinary. I mean, I remember even here in Montreal, the next day I was at Dorval Airport, at Trudeau Airport. I couldn't find a newspaper, not in French, not in English. Everybody wanted to own a piece of history. Everybody felt this was momentous. And what we saw from that night was two very important ideas. One, democracies that work, the United States, Canada, have self-corrective mechanisms. That's the beauty of democracy. That a democracy can fix itself, most of the time peacefully. That notion of this African-American, not just at any time in history, but particularly again after 9/11, being elected, was extraordinary. So we see the self-corrective power of democracy. And the second idea, which is in some ways more of an American idea, although we see echoes of it in other democracies, is the redemptive quality of American politics. Americans do have a particular yearning for Messiah. They have a particular openness to yes, we can kind of sloganeering. A man from hope. Anybody remember who that was? Bill Clinton. Right? It was very funny, you know, because everybody say, I'm so excited, people who loved Obama, I'm so excited Barack Obama. There's never been a candidate who made me feel so good in my lifetime. I said, do you remember Bill Clinton in 1992? Everybody said that he was our generation's John Kennedy, and now Barack Obama was our generation's John Kennedy. And that constant reinvention shows for a search for redemption, and Barack Obama gave it. And then, of course, comes the inauguration. Barack Obama had given at least three really extraordinary speeches during the campaign, and then had given this amazing speech in Grant Park the night of the election, and everybody's waiting. And you know what? He gave a pretty sobering inauguration address. There were 2 million people freezing. It was a really cold day out there, down there in Washington. I was very arrogant because having spent, I didn't like the fact that we counted as 20 years, but it is indeed 20 years, because it means I'm old. 20 years here, I said, you know, I'll put on my good old Canadian long johns and a couple of layers and my hat, and I'll be fine. And it was so cold that day. What was amazing was despite the literal freezing weather, there was a warmth in the crowd. And the crowd was all there looking for redemption. And Barack Obama gave up and gave a rather sobering speech because I think he realized, oh my goodness, we've got a lot on our plate. I'm seeing a little bit of the rhetoric of my students. This is a big deal. Oh my goodness, what are we doing here? And he didn't want at that moment to raise expectations. He wanted to start lowering expectations because he was in the transition from the poetry of politics, the poetry of campaigning, to the prose of governance. And that's what we're going to talk about, the prose of governance. Now, one of the problems that critics had was because Obama was the first African-American president, they didn't quite know how to criticize him at first. They've gotten over that. And so one of the ways they did, and you see this is from day one, so this is from the first day, is, and you know, let's speak crassly, directly. Right? One of the issues was cartoonists especially didn't know what to do. How do they play with his facial features in a way that doesn't play into traditional racism? And so they brilliantly settled on the ears. Spock's ears, that's safe. And so they talked about him as the hyper-rationalist president. Nowhere am I so desperately needed as among a shipload of illogical humans. And they played him up as Mr. Spock. Now, that's changed a little bit as we now see a later one. This is from the campaign of 2010. I wish Jim would get back. I have no idea how to run the ship. Uhura's rolling her eyes. So we go from Obama as sort of super perfectionist to now being super rationalist, but not all that effective. Other initial criticisms of Obama was, you may recall that during the campaign, think about it, and I go back to the fact that I'd mentioned his managerial inexperience. He was a new kid on the block. It was an all but flawless campaign. He beat two pros in American politics. in hand-to-hand combat. Hillary Clinton and John McCain, let alone all those others like Joe Biden and Chris Dodd, who fell by the wayside so quickly. But he ran a flawless campaign, all but flawless campaign. And one of the mistakes that he made was at one point, he was in San Francisco, and he was at a fundraiser, and he forgot that when you're running for president, the microphone is always on, and the tape recorder is always going, and the blogosphere is always out there waiting for you to make a mistake. And he gave his speculation about how could it be that lower-class and middle-class Americans are foolish enough to not be Democrats, was basically what he was talking about. And he talked about how they're bitter, and as a result of the bitterness, they hide behind desire for gun control. And so the result was these two cartoons where you have Barack Obama going, I'm sorry if my bitterness about my comments about bitterness in middle America came across as elitist. I didn't know the commoners were so sensitive. And Barack Obama, this is from the famous New Yorker cartoon, that his view of America was a little bit of middle America, Mexico, Washington, D.C., and it's elitist bitters. I saw this, I saw the criticism, and I said, hallelujah, what a great country. Think about it. The first African American to run for president is accused of being elitist, too Harvardian, too fancy pants. That's a great story. Here we see another classic attack on him from the campaign. He's doing what I do. Having had a bike accident 6 months ago, I'm very happy that I do what he does, which is put on my bike helmet and, you know, make sure that we don't have, you know, bell bottoms or anything that'll get caught in the gears. But look what they did with him on the internet. They compared biker babe Palin versus Pee Wee Obama. One is a total dork. One is a total babe. One is a socialist. One is a populist. The choice keeps getting easier and easier. And here we see an attack on him that started early in the campaign that disappeared, but now we see coming back. This is, again, it goes from that, you know, and Dan Quayle, you may recall, suffered from this. You know, I'm not sure if every one of us on the spot could spell potato correctly. But when you're vice president of the United States and you're running a spelling bee, don't make a mistake. It becomes famous. Gerald Ford, remember him, president of the United States in the 1970s, suffered from this. He was an athlete. He was such a graceful athlete that he was signed up to be a pro football professional. But when he came down the steps one day, rain-slicked steps, in Austria, at a ceremony, he stumbled, and the frame became Gerald Ford the Klutz. And you may recall Chevy Chase of Saturday Night Live basically built a career and built Saturday Night Live as a franchise when it first started in the 1970s, making fun of Gerald Ford. So here, he's unfortunately at the front of the line, not at the back of the line, so they're doing the God Bless America thing, and he doesn't put his hand on his heart, so he becomes unpatriotic, and it becomes this whole nuclear arms race about who has, and this is very, Canadians love to have their little lapel pins, this is, you know, Americans don't do lapel pins like Canadians do, but, you know, now you have to have a bigger and bigger, bigger American flag, such that, you know, so now my lapel pin has cubic zirconia sparkle, very nice, John, but my lapel is 24 karat white gold, I can't tell if this is CNN or HSN, the Home Shopping Network. Home Shopping is better guests. So this is the environment that Obama started with. And what I want to do now is I want to look at the five categories of challenges that he's struggling with. And the first is empirical, and I want to be very careful about the spelling. It's not about empire. You know, Canadians sometimes misread America. It's all about empire. Empirical challenges, the objective challenges. It's a tough job. I have to say, my completely non-intellectual, instinctive reaction to hearing the news of the first wave of protests in Egypt was, God, I'm so glad I'm not president of the United States. What do? We love democracy. We hate dictatorship. But we also love stability and we love our friends. It's a hard choice to make. We see here that, and one of the frames we're starting to see, one of the critiques of Obama that's emerged is that he's not decisive enough and that he's distracted. Right? And right now, during these last couple of weeks, where there's been, in fact, in the New York Times yesterday, there was an article about the American people not even getting a good read on the Libya situation. Why? Because of headline fatigue. Every day there seems to be a new crisis, Japan and Libya and Egypt, and the mind reels. And the president often has this dilemma. Do you stick to business as usual? Do you continue on your South American tour as planned? Or do you cancel it? Do you continue to make those little symbolic moments, those things that make Americans feel good about you just as a human being? So there may be a crisis in Libya going on, but even more important to most Americans, there's an NCAA basketball tournament going on. And so the President of the United States decided, they call it the brackets. You have to sort of guess, or not guess, you're going to make a very scientific assessment based on your betting patterns, of who you think is going to get from one round to the next round to the next round. And so this cartoon is making fun of the fact that Obama decided to stick to his instincts and follow his basketball, his love for basketball, and play with the NCAA brackets. And now they're saying maybe we can channel his decision-making this way and make it more decisive. And here you have a sense of, around the table, how many issues there are. Of course, the biggest issue to Americans remains the economic crisis. Unemployment at 9.4 or 9.7% is devastating. It's doubly devastating because 9.4 or 9.7% unemployment is a false figure. That's a figure showing how many people are still on the job market and not getting jobs. It doesn't talk about the millions, literally millions of people who have simply given up. And so when you have an unemployment rate of 9.4, 9.7%, I've seen different economists, they have different theories, but they talk about a true unemployment rate of as high as 15 or 17% of the working age population. That's devastating. So the markets may be back. The banks are getting their bonuses. But millions of Americans are suffering. Sorry, kid, your resume looks good, but you only have a master's degree, and all the other applicants for a McDonald's job are PhDs. So you'll go to Burger King. This question of, and for us in the university, is of course so important because we know that parents are always, we're always asking the student, what's your fancy? Right? What's your quest? What kind of thinker do you want to be? And they're saying, how are you going to make money? Why are you wasting your time with history and useless things like that? We know that one of the major issues of his first term, this, of course, Canadians are particularly interested in, was health care and the complexity of that debate. Again, wherever you stand on the political spectrum, left, right, center, to try to solve that problem that deals with 1/7 of the American economy, that really gets to sort of fundamental questions of what kind of government America should have, what kind of country America should be, and how I can make sure that I get the top-notch health care as soon as I can, because that's the most important thing for me when I'm ill, when I'm injured, is not easy. And one of the debates that historians are going to continue to debate for the next 50 years, okay, I'm predicting, this is, I think, an easy prediction, is the choice that Barack Obama made in his first term to focus on health care as opposed to the economy. Now, part of his answer is that he had no choice, and that actually was a way of ultimately trying to heal the economy. But that was certainly a big issue and had a major factor in the 2010 campaign, which we'll be talking about. And here we see him hosting the head of China, and it's our honor to treat you to dinner, but could you give us a few bucks to cover it? The degree to which China has become such a major lender to the United States. And, you know, one of the things that Barack Obama talked about beautifully and powerfully and intelligently during the campaign, which we haven't heard much, was he had a kind of whole structural critique of the American economy and the American polity. And he was saying, there are serious issues going on. Energy. New powers out there. What do we do? How do we take our 20th century story and turn it into a 21st century story? How do we create 21st century structures? And that's fallen off the wayside because of all these empirical challenges, because every day the President of the United States has a to-do list that would kill any of us. And as Dwight Eisenhower warned John Kennedy, all the easy answers don't end up on your desk. The only decisions that end up on your desk are the hard ones. The easy ones can be decided down the chain of command. And so every day you're struggling with really hard dilemmas. And that's actually one of the reasons why I think it's important for us to call for civility, to understand just how hard these choices are. A lack of civility comes from a lack of understanding of complexity. And we in the university have to be a center of understanding of complexity and acknowledgement of complexity, which can then lead to civility. And so, of course, we're talking about the domestic side, but, of course, on the foreign policy side, we see Obama's repeated attempts to stretch his hand out and greet Ahmadinejad of Iran, and this cartoonist's take on the peace talks, death to America, America's the true terrorist, God curse your pig Zionist nation. What do you have to say to that? Will you baptize my next child? Sense of how does Obama respond to his friends and how does he respond to his enemies? Look at that. It's so clear, it's so easy when you're a historian, when you're a journalist, when you're in the opposition to talk about how he blew it, to be critical. But the whole question, as I said earlier, of what to do about Egypt is very complicated. And here we see Obama's stand on Libya. Ring, 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 the phone is ringing, right? And that's an echo of what? The commercial that Hillary Clinton ran against Barack Obama in the Texas primary. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, and the phone is ringing, and the phone is ringing. Who do you trust to answer the phone? Now, my take on that commercial was, if you recall, the commercial is ringing, 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 and Hillary didn't answer the phone either, but we'll put that aside. And so this cartoonist, and this is one of the things, you know, when we see these cartoons, when we hear these speeches, we're swimming in a sea of references, some very superficial, and some, as hopefully you'll see soon, more enduring. But this is, and I've given you a short version of Obama's agenda, of what's on his plate. Right? I implicitly critiqued him for not dealing with underlying structural issues. But how can you deal with underlying structural issues when every day is a 3-alarm fire? When every day another country is popping up and on your mattering map that you hadn't thought about? Who really thought about Bahrain? Right? One of the things that's been interesting about this is, you know, people, you know, who sort of follow politics have been making fun of the fact that Muammar Gaddafi had been in power for decades. And they sort of knew, if you thought about it, that Mubarak had been in power for decades. But nobody thought just how many other Arab rulers in the neighborhood, who would have thought the leader of Tunisia had been there for so long? When you're president of the United States, you have to think about that. Not only that, but you have to become an instant expert on that at that moment when you have to make a decision which can involve life and death, as we're seeing now in Libya. Said again, very short version of the empirical challenges. Those empirical challenges, those day-to-day crises and complexities are confronted every day also by a political environment, a political set of challenges. And here we see the most important political challenge. We live in the age of the instant communication, instant poll, instant judgment. And as a result, we live in the age of the permanent campaign. It used to be that you could sort of put off issues, put off political complexities. But now they're thrown at you every day, and now we have this 24/7 media, which exaggerates even more. So we see how his popularity, right, 60%, he started at a high, and he's the blue line. The low point is when, in November 2010, when the Republicans had the surge and shifted powers in Congress, and now we see that he's a little bit on the way up. And notice here with the job ratings, we see that Obama has gone from 64% to 51%. We see the Republican leaders have really, in 3 months, shifted from a low of 24% now to 36%, and the Democratic leaders have been pretty much trending down 48% to 33%. And it's a mix. We have a tendency, one of the occupational hazards of being what's called a presidential historian is we obsess too much about the presidency, right? And there's Congress, there's the courts, there's governors. We've been seeing that in Wisconsin, if you've been following, in New Jersey, right? There's state legislatures. It's a complex political system. And as I've alluded to already, we see that there was a huge shift. That when Barack Obama started in January 2009, he had a House of Representatives with a very strong Democratic majority of 257 and a Senate of 57 Democrats. And now he has a shift where he has a Republican House with 241 Republicans and still 51 Democrats, but it's a much smaller margin. And so we see happy new Congress, and we see John Boehner, the House Speaker, says, I officially gavel the start of the 112th Congress, bonk, bonk, bonk. And the challenge here is, who is Obama? Who is Obama? What's his bottom line? What are his core principles? What is he willing to go to the mat for? That's one level of questions about who Barack Obama is. The second level of questions is, what's his style? What's his mode? What's his approach? Is he the moderate the accommodator, the conciliator? Or is he more the radical, the extremist? And we hear one of the problems that Republicans have is they often accuse him of being both. And you want to be consistent in your attacks if you want to be effective in your attacks. But here we see, making fun of him as the moderate, made for listening, we have nothing in common. He seems to be willing to meet us halfway, and the Republicans, the elephants represent the Republicans, are cutting him out from under. He's begging for compromise, and the Republicans are saying, haven't the rich suffered enough? And here, perhaps my favorite, Obama peeled potatoes, we must repeal them. Get it? And this is, I'm putting it through the Obama lens, but now let's shift lenses. What does this cartoon say about the Republican challenge? The Republicans have to show that they're not the party of no. Obama has to show that he can truly be the party of yes, we can. That he can be the party who can heal the nation, who can take a divided Congress and go forward still. But the Republicans have to show that they're not just obstructionists. That they have their own vision. And they're not just playing a game of trying to score points. Short version of the political challenges. The third level of challenges, what I'm calling ideological challenges. And it really gets to that important document that was written in the 1780s. And it's now the 2010s, the Constitution. What's the nature of American government? What's the role of the president? How obstructionist can he be or should he be? How constructive should he be or can he be? What are the limits of power? There's a wonderful book that was written by Howard Fineman, reporter for Newsweek. And it's called The 13 Arguments That Shape America. And he shows that there are 13 fundamental conflicts. Limited government, expanded government. Liberty, equality. And then you can understand many of the issues that are going on right now by looking at those challenges. And here we see the big question really is, and certainly Canadians have a different take on it than Americans, as a whole, of how big should government be? How big should the welfare state be? How do you balance that complicated equation between individual equality and individual freedom and social justice and collective quality of life? You need to cut back so we withheld the sprinkles. The whole problem of the deficit, right? And is it a problem? Paul Krugman of the New York Times is constantly saying, the deficit isn't a problem during a time of recession. Spend, 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 stimulate the economy, get it going, then you'll figure it out. And here we get to that other issue with health care. I'm sick and tired of being unemployed. The American people have expressed to me their need for health care. Right? Why did he address the issue of health care? And what does that show really about his vision of government and his understanding of what the American people should be involved in? And Republican Teak, I'm voting for Obama because he's the type of guy who would give you the shirt off his back. And it's the taxpayer who's giving the shirt off his back. The oppression of the taxpayer. Right? There was a very interesting exchange during the Bush administration between George W. Bush and the late Senator Kennedy about taxes. When it came to cutting taxes, George W. Bush talked about returning the people's money to the people. When Kennedy responded, he talked about the nation's money, and that the nation needed a certain amount of money. And that really gets to, again, the fundamental question. So sometimes when you're reading the newspaper and Democrats and Republicans are arguing about something which seems very minor, they're actually arguing about a deep, enduring question that gets to visions of social justice, visions of equality, visions of liberty. That's on the domestic side of things. And then you go to the foreign side of things. Again, when we hear tonight the speech that Obama's going to give at 7:30, the ghost of George Washington will be in that room. George Washington, when he was retiring, of course, you know, when you're the first president of the United States, everything you do sets a precedent. There was one moment where he came and he testified in front of the Senate, and George Washington was a man of great dignity. And the senators were so annoying with their questioning and so aggressive that he walked out and said, I'm never going to go in there again. And that became the precedent whereby in Canada we have question period, in England we have question period where the Prime Minister goes back and forth with people in Parliament, and the United States, they don't. Simply because he had a fit of pique, he had a temper tantrum that day. And that, so George Washington decided on the way out that he would give a farewell address, and so now every president gives a farewell address. And in his farewell address, George Washington's message to the American people was enjoy that beautiful Atlantic Ocean. And enjoy that landmass, and now the Pacific Ocean. We are isolated. We should be isolationist. He didn't use those words. Those are the words that became later. Don't get involved. He warned about entangling alliances. That is his word then, his phrase then. Don't get too involved in the messes of Europe. That's one of the extraordinary things we have as Americans. We have an independence. And so when Barack Obama is explaining why we're involved in Libya, he's going to have to explain to the American people how that reconciles with the mission of Americans, the instincts of Americans, not to get too involved. And it'll be really interesting. You have to listen tonight. It'll have echoes of Woodrow Wilson's speech on the eve of World War I, Franklin Roosevelt's speech after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Is he going to pitch it as something that we need to do for ourselves, that Americans are ultimately threatened by this action that's going on in Libya when Gaddafi shoots down the rebels? Or is he going to pitch it as altruistic? How does he do it? And of course, he's the president who ran on a platform against George W. Bush, saying we shouldn't get too involved in wars, we shouldn't have complicated interventions. Although he was very careful to say, he said, he has a great line, he said, in the campaign. He said, I'm not against wars, I'm just against dumb wars. And there's a great new book out, which I just read over this weekend, by Stephen Carter, calling, I have to get it right, it's called The Violence of Peace. And he talks about the challenge that Barack Obama has, having come in promising peace, and saying that sometimes in order to ensure peace, you have to indulge in war. Fourth challenge is what I'm calling the lyrical challenge. Here, you'll recall, and this goes back to a little bit of my introduction, the high expectations that surrounded Barack Obama, especially with the frustrations around George W. Bush. The 2008 presidential race, I'm testing the water. He said, and some people thought that he did, walked on water. We talked about his 2004 campaign speech already. We have to remember that at the height of the campaign, at a very difficult moment when it turned out that his pastor, his preacher, his spiritual mentor, Jeremiah Wright, was anti-white, and a racist in that way against white people. And Barack Obama got up and he addressed the issue and he saw that his campaign was under attack, and he spoke very beautifully about the complicated issue about race in America. And he showed a tremendous ability at that time, during that campaign, to heal the nation with his words, to heal the nation with his vision. I haven't heard that, Barack Obama, in the last 2 years. He got up and he gave a speech before a joint session of Congress during the health care debate. 20 minutes later, I couldn't tell you, and I listened. I couldn't tell you one memorable phrase. I couldn't tell you one moment that made my heart soar, that lifted us up as a people. When, during the campaign, it happened again and again. And so people say, where's he gone? Has he become this empty suit? Sir, you need to work on this damaging perception that you're a bloodless technocrat. Take the economy. It doesn't seem to be getting much better. People are still suffering. Now forget for a moment what you think about it. How does it make you feel? It makes me feel like thinking. We're in trouble. Has he become too much the automaton, too much the computer? Here, I love this. Make agonizingly slow decisions or make pretty speeches, the two modes of President Obama. And that's the critique that's emerging. And I think that Americans need some of that lyricism during this time of confusion in the international arena, during this time of trauma in the economy, continuing trauma, because of this redemptive quality I was talking about in American politics. And finally, underlying all this are serious structural problems. We see the whole question of corporate America and tax cuts and banks, and how do you reconfigure the economy. We see the whole question of what's the role of the media. Here's a critique of the media coverage during the Obama campaign. I have to apologize, these next two slides are a little bit crude, but it's important to sort of see the language and see the imagery and see the way people talk. And they're saying that, you know, that one of the critiques was that Barack Obama was such a media superstar that even reporters were sort of overcome. Look, Senator Obama's going to speak. Oh, it's him, Keith. I think I just peed a little. Like people seem sort of losing their control. And here, again, I apologize for the sexist imagery, but the vulgarity of what we see is, you know, a perception that the media is no longer objective, if it ever was. Right? You have to be careful about our language, right? But that's the language that's used. It's no longer objective. And now we have Fox News in bed with the Republicans. We have MSNBC and CNN in bed with the Democrats. Is that true? Is it not true? What does it mean? How does it affect our politics? We see the whole question of Sarah Palin and the Republicans, and have they become so addicted to the fight and to the ugliness that we can't have the kind of civility I was talking about? We see an attack, because it seemed unfair to just have attacks on Barack Obama. She'd have a couple of attacks on the Insanity Party. It's communism, folks, fascist dictatorship, socialist forced re-education camps, all steeped in paranoia. I love that image, huh? Steeped, getting rather you steep tea, right? Steeped in paranoia. Is the attack on Barack Obama a genuine, sincere critique of his politics? Or is it an underlying racism to all of it, some of it, none of it? And here, this notion of America being unruly, America, especially in the age of the blogosphere, being out of control, the birthers, Obama's a Muslim, right? And Colin Powell, former Secretary of State, had such a brilliant response at the end of the campaign. We said, he's not, but even if he is, so what? So what? And he talked about a young man from New Jersey who had been killed in Iraq and been buried in American soil who had a Muslim name. And he said, that's not the America we want to be. We want to be in America where we judge people by their religion. We want to be in America where we judge people by their actions and by who they are and by their commitment is to the country. And, of course, this whole question of red America and blue America, which is what we started with, which is what he started with in 2004. And this is the map that you see. I should mention that unlike in Canada where there's a kind of real history to the colors of the parties, this is just random. It came from a Washington Post electoral map that was put up and became the map that they used during the 2000 campaign, during that deadlock. Remember that lovely moment between Bush and Gore where we couldn't figure out who was going to be president? So this is the map we usually see emphasizing how divided America is. This shows that in many ways America is much more purple and that you can find a little bit of a pattern city-country, but it's not as simple. This is the division that really started it all in 2004 with John Kerry winning all those few blue states and George Bush getting the red states. And you may recall that there was a fear or hope, it depended on where you were from the state, that what we needed to do was have two different countries, the United States of Canada and Jesus Land. And to sum up, what we really need to heal, to go forward, to understand, to sift through some of these challenges, is a little bit of historical perspective. And one way of thinking about it is every president is ultimately judged through the lens of previous presidents. And we see that Barack Obama is being compared, I think, in particular to two presidents. One is Ronald Reagan. Ideologically and stylistically, ideologically, the issue here, as you see in this cartoon, is government is not the solution to the problem. Government is the problem. That was Reagan. We have to shrink government. And Obama, the critique is that he's saying government is the solution to every problem. That's one dimension. But there's another, to me, even more intriguing dimension. In January 2008, when Barack Obama was running against Hillary Clinton, he was in Nevada, on the eve of the Nevada primary, and he said, a very clever line which drove the Clintons crazy, he said, I want to be a transformational president like Ronald Reagan, not like Bill Clinton. So the Clintons went bananas, and the next night in a debate, Hillary Clinton, what did she accuse him of? She accused him of trying to embrace Ronald Reagan's ideology, of Ronald Reagan's program. And that's not what he was saying. What he was saying was, Reagan made a change. Reagan made a difference. Reagan was a transformational president. Reagan, I call him, the greatest president since FDR, not saying he's the best president since FDR, but since Franklin Roosevelt, there hasn't been a president who made as much of a change in the American tone, in the American structures of government, as Ronald Reagan. And Barack Obama, from the start, was grading himself on that curve, on that high standard. And so when we think of Obama versus Reagan, we think of two things. We think about this whole question of government, which you know is a political question and an empirical challenge and an ideological challenge, which requires lyrical debate and leadership. But ultimately it's a historical question. And we also think stylistically about what he's going to accomplish. And there's also a question of, is Barack Obama going to become the next Jimmy Carter? Jimmy Carter wasn't all that bad, so let's give him a second term. Barack Hussein Obama, the use of that middle name is a way to delegitimize him, the second chance that Jimmy never had. And here too we see interesting balances. On the one hand, there is a certain kind of comparison between Barack Obama's mode of politics, his approach, and Jimmy Carter. Ideologically, they're closer than Reagan and Obama are. But I think every single day of his presidency, Barack Obama wakes up, and if he's a praying man, he says, please don't make me like Jimmy Carter. And when he faces economic challenges like Jimmy Carter faced, and then he faces a Middle East exploding like Jimmy Carter faced, you see him, I think, very consciously trying to make sure that he's not doing that. And so ultimately, and with this I'll end so we can have some questions, comments, disagreements, and discussion, is it's all really about what they call in the United States the big enchilada. I hate to break it to you folks, but the 2012 campaign has already begun. Even though Barack Obama hasn't yet announced his re-election campaign, even Sarah Palin hasn't announced her candidacy, even though Newt Gingrich hasn't yet announced his presidency, all the latest I saw was that he's talking about announcing in the next 2 weeks. We're already seeing front page of the New York Times 2 days ago talking about what's going on in Iowa. Because in January 2012, which is not that far away, the caucuses begin. And the fight, yeah, I'm with you, I'm shaking my head too, it's unbelievable. And the fight over who will lead the Republicans, the fight over who will lead the Democrats is already on. And for us as observers, for us as learners, the question is always how to sort of be seeing this in all these different modes. The empirical mode, the political mode, the ideological mode, the lyrical mode, the structural mode, without getting confused. And without getting, how did Brian Mulrooney put it, so disagreeable even when we disagree. How do we learn? I think this is something that we need to teach from this place, from these hallowed halls. How to learn about politics and talk about politics without always descending into the gutter, without all descending into the vulgarity. And with that, I thank you for your attention and invite questions, comments, disagreements. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Professor Troy, you've outlined the high expectations, the complexities, and the rhetoric that have characterized Obama's first term. But you haven't really given us your views of what you consider his successes and his failures. If we're talking about historical judgment, surely we, even though it might be a little early, we should have some idea of how to approach his accomplishments or lack thereof.
Well, that's a good question, and indeed I plead guilty because my goal today was to try to set the historical table for you, get you thinking about it without necessarily making those judgments for two reasons. First of all, because I was trying to show how we talk about politics without being partisan. And secondly, because I was very upset during the Bush administration when starting from, he was elected in 2000, you can decide whether he was elected or not elected, whatever. He became president, let's say, we'll be safe. He became president in 2001. See, I'm trying to be cautious today. He became president in 2001, and within 2.5 years, we saw it in Rolling Stone, we saw it in polls of the historians. Historians who were supposed to take a breath and evaluate were already declaring him the worst president ever. Now, love him or hate him, I felt that it was premature. So that is why I sidestepped it, but I'll try to at least answer your question somehow by focusing on what I think are two mistakes that he's made and two smart moves that he's made. Okay, two mistakes that I think he made. One, I think he made a historic mistake in giving over the health care debate to the Congress. And it comes from my bias as a presidential historian. And it comes from my inability as someone who is paid whatever they pay us at McGill to follow this. I can't explain the health care bill to you really clearly. I think there are 300 million people in the United States who can. It became, and this really goes to my bias as a presidential historian, I think we made a mistake. He made a mistake by allowing that very important bill to get bogged down in the complexities and the power dimensions and the power games of the Congress. And as a result, and now we have the real, we risk the worst of both worlds, which is a cobbled together piece of legislation from the Democratic-led Congress now being killed with a dying the death of 1,000 cuts by a Republican Congress. That, to me, is the worst of both worlds, wherever you stand on health care. So I think that was a mistake. And I think on foreign policy, what I haven't heard from him is I haven't heard his core values. Ronald Reagan believed with his heart and soul that communism was evil. It led him to realize just how evil the Soviet Union was and to help push for its collapse. It also misled him and got him into a mess with the Iran-Contra because he could only play in one mode, but you knew where he stood. You need to know sometimes where a president stands. One of the things I'm going to be listening for tonight is I want to know where he stands. So far, I haven't heard that. So those are two critiques. Two achievements that we've seen in his administration. Number one is, I think, for all the problems and all the divisions, he healed America in many ways. I think if you go back to the national mood the day before he was elected, and you go to the national mood during his inauguration, that was an extraordinary transformation, that was an extraordinary turnaround, and that is a historic achievement. I don't know if I'd give him the Nobel Peace Prize for it, but I certainly think that when we historians evaluate him, we'll be having to talk about that. And secondly, I think when we look back and we look at the stimulus package, and we look at some of the economic decisions he has made, we'll see that a lot of them were reflected the economic collective wisdom of the time. And I'm putting it that cautiously because I don't know enough about economics. I don't think economists know enough about economics. But he captured the bipartisan nature of it because there really was more continuity than discontinuity between the way Bush approached it and the way Obama approached it. And while we haven't yet seen it in the unemployment numbers, I think we did see it in the market. We have seen it in a certain kind of economic stability. So there, too, I'm giving you two and two. Questions, comments, disagreements? Yes, sir.
Professor, I wonder if you can comment on the apparent similarities that Obama has experienced with President Clinton did in terms of the ups and downs of his first 2 years in office. Came in with so much promise, disillusioned his base quickly, and got shellacked at the midterm elections, and apparently now seems to be bouncing back.
It's a very good question. This is the flip side of that redemptive quality that we see in American politics. We sometimes see a manic depressive quality to American politics. And I think it's particularly exaggerated in what I was talking about earlier, the age of the permanent campaign, the age of constant polls, the age of 24/7 news, and now the age of the blogosphere, where just untrammeled criticism and comments are out there all the time. And I would extend it. It's interesting that you're making the comparison between Clinton and Obama. I feel that it's in some ways very similar to what we see also in the Bush terms, and with Reagan, too. And one of the things, you know, again, I'm avoiding prognostication, but one of the things that we saw with Reagan was that Reagan, too, came in with a lot of hope, was shellacked in the midterms, to use your language, and what happened? The economy kicked in. The economy kicked in around 1983. 1981, they were already talking about the Reagan recession. He had inherited it from Carter, but then it got worse, and so now they could name it the Reagan recession. By 1983, because most American recessions don't last that long, things started improving, inflation dropped, and all of a sudden, boom, we had morning in America, and he was reelected. That is the structure, economically, that Barack Obama is hoping will happen. And that's where those numbers that I talked about at the beginning, the 9.7, 9.4 unemployment rate, are so dangerous for Obama, because it hasn't kicked in yet. Now, again, it's still a little bit early, but the closer we get to, I'd say, June 2012, arbitrary, but that also you see that in Carter's term. When Carter, in June 1980, was still stuck in incredibly high inflation, incredibly high interest rates, his presidency was all but doomed. And that's the race, I think, in the White House, whether they can change the numbers, whether they can change the economic story around by then. But fundamentally, what we're really talking about is, in a postpartisan age, what used to be called the postpartisan age, now we have a hyperpartisan age. And the intensity of the fight has gotten very, very ugly, and it means that it's very hard to sort of relax and do it. I mean, again, think about and I gave a very simplified version of what his daily agenda is like. When you're doing that, and on top of that you have this noise of politics, it's very, very hard to make the right decision. Yes.
Thanks. I kind of want to ask about just the way elections happen and the media's role in acting sort of as an intermediary between politicians and the public. Something that really struck out to me about the midterm elections was the way in which it seemed like nobody was really forced to give any answers to tough questions. I remember the Republican leadership came out with that document about the economy, I think it was like a 20-page document that had no real details. And they were pressed a little bit on the Sunday morning talk shows about, well, where are the details, where exactly are the cuts, and in the debates that came up. But answers weren't ever really given, and then it was kind of let go of. So I wonder if what that's about, or maybe part of it is that the public just won't accept tough answers. I remember Walter Mondale famously said, like, well, we will have to raise some taxes. And universally, everyone was like, well, that was the dumbest thing you could have ever said. So,
how dare you be honest?
Yeah, so just wondering your comments on that.
No, that's a very good question. There are three different parts to that, at least three. One is, you're right, the media has imposed itself as the intermediary. I like the way you're using the language, right? Because and the media has made itself the forum and the high court and executioner for campaigns. And with that should come certain responsibility. And instead what we've seen is the growth of what you really responded to, which is the horse race. That the headlines, and we have content analysis showing just what percentage of headlines in newspapers as well as on radio and TV, and now on the internet, are just about who's up and who's down. In that clatter of who's up and who's down is lost the substance. There's no opportunity for substance. And that gets to the third dimension of your question, which is, and here we do have to point a little bit of a finger at the American people, but also at the complexity of the problem. How do you have an intelligent conversation with 300 million people about politics? It's the beauty of democracy. It's the joy of our civilization that we have these kind of open forums. But we can't have New England town meetings anymore. We're not the Greeks. What do we do? And the problem is that it gets filtered through that filter called popular culture. And in a world where Michael Jackson is still king and Elvis Presley still lives, how do we expect complicated questions to these complicated problems, complicated answers to these complicated questions to somehow get through that media din? We're far more excited about Britney and all kinds of Simpsons, real and imagined. But they're all imagined, right? And I think, you know, when we talk about this in class, I often talk about, you know, the problem, the toxicity of celebrity culture, the toxicity of consumer culture. And we see what it does. It does a number on our heads, and it does a number on our politics. I saw, yes? I'll give you the pros and cons. The strongest thing that Barack Obama has going for him right now, in addition to being president, is that as of this moment, it doesn't look like he's going to have a challenger in the primary. First of all, in the primaries, let alone in the elections. But let's talk about in the primaries first. There hasn't been the only presidents who have lost in the last 50 years: Jimmy Carter, who have lost the attempts at re-election. Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush, were first. Gerald Ford, were first opposed by a primary within. And that does two things. The primary within weakens you, and it also forces you to go either to your left or your right. And so far, it looks like Barack Obama isn't going to have that problem, which means that his election prospects go up. The other thing, you're right, boosting his electoral prospects are the fact that you have an array of Republican candidates, each of whom at this point looks less appropriate than the next. Sarah Palin has the name recognition and the ability to raise money, but she also has a tremendous ability to turn people off and alienate thousands, especially millions, especially people in the middle. Someone like Mitt Romney, we've talked about the prejudice against African Americans in this country, in the United States. We have to talk about the prejudice against Mormons in the country. And the fact that he's a Mormon will be very difficult in terms of running and getting the evangelical Protestant vote, I'm sorry to say. The fact that he's a boring candidate also doesn't help. You have, I mean, my Republican sources in Washington, you know, there are these, and I apologize for the expression, but, you know, they have these great white hopes, these great, you know, modern hopes. One of them is Bobby Jindal, who's an Indian American from Louisiana. But he gave a terrible speech in response to Barack Obama's first State of the Union speech. And you make mistakes sometimes. Bill Clinton gave a famously bad nomination speech in 1988. For Michael Dukakis, that went on so long that when he said, and in conclusion, a roar! went up in the Democratic National Convention. But Clinton was smart enough the next day to get on Johnny Carson, Remember Him, with his saxophone and charm the American people and make fun of himself. Bobby Jindal was so humiliated by his performance that we haven't seen him since. And that was his mistake. His mistake wasn't making the mistake. His mistake was not knowing. It's an important thing to teach our students. He couldn't recover. They talk about Mitch Daniels. They talk about Tim Pawlenty. The fact that everybody's going, huh, is the problem, because you get the same response in an American audience. So, yes, right now, the Republicans don't really have much, don't have an obvious contender. But, you know, Barack Obama, holy Obama, when you read, there are all these great books about the campaign, they remind us how frequently it seemed that Obama was never going to win. Anyway, I want to thank you for taking your lunch hour and devoting it to hopefully a discussion about politics without partisanship. Thank you very much.